Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 108. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, Professor Walter Brueggemann. After the conversation in this episode, I will report on some changes in our services. If you're new to this podcast or would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. Walter Brueggemann is surely one of the most influential Bible interpreters of our time. He is the author of over 100 books and numerous scholarly articles. He continues to be a highly sought-after speaker. This is my third conversation with Walter Brueggemann on Simple Living Works podcast. In episode 69, we talked about his devotional book, Sabbath, Saying No to the Culture of Now. In Numbers 84 and 85, we talked about his scholarly volume, Money and Possessions. In this episode, we talk about four recent books, three devotional books for Advent, Lent, and the full year, then Rebuilding the Foundations, Social Relationships in Ancient Scripture and Contemporary Culture, which he co-wrote with his sociologist son, John. Here's Walter Brueggemann, recently recorded. Well, last time we talked about one of your scholarly books, about money and possessions. This time we're going to talk about some of your more recent devotional writings. We did talk a couple of years ago about your devotional book about the Sabbath. I'm glad to see that it's been reissued now with the study guide. So that's good news.
Yes, and it's been well received. I've been surprised about that, but I think Sabbath is on the mind and heart of a lot of people who feel that they're losing the rat race. So,
yep. Indeed. Well, recently you've issued a book called Celebrating Abundance, Devotions for Advent. Abundance really resonates with me, of course, because with Simple Living Works, we focus on abundance. That is, that there's enough for everybody's need, not for anybody's greed.
Well, that book, you likely know, consists in excerpts from a variety of my writings. But I have been, as you know, at work a long time on the gospel affirmation of God's abundance that contradicts the notion of scarcity around which we've organized most of our social life. To believe in the scarcity, that there's not enough to go around, is a very pernicious and destructive idea, because it leads to anxiety and it leads to greed, and eventually it leads to violence. And for that reason, the gospel claims about God's abundance seem to me to be an enormously important, attractive option that is grounded in our conviction of God's creation, in which God blessed creation and made it fruitful, and which is then performed by Jesus in his feeding miracles, in which he feeds hungry crowds and has an abundance of bread left over. So I think that struggle between the common assumption of scarcity and the gospel affirmation of abundance is a hugely central issue around which we have to do a lot of work.
And talking about abundance is good any time of the year, not just in Advent.
Well, that's correct. I think it's a major theme of the Christian life, but it does come up at Christmas because of our temptation to incredible self-indulgence, or indulgence for those whom we love most closely, to the neglect of other people. But you're right, the issue and the promise of abundance do not go away with the passing of the Christmas season.
And as a little side note here, I'm really glad your books are available in electronic editions as well. For us older guys who like to blow up the type and have trouble reading small type in paper books. So I'm really glad of that.
Well, I'm glad if you're glad about that. That's not something to which I pay any attention, and I didn't know that, so I'm glad about it. Good.
Now, moving on to your new collection for this year, Gift and Task. This is a book of daily devotions for the entire year, not the calendar year, but the church year, starting with Advent. And it also has a theme of abundance.
Well, that's right. What I did in that rather long labor for 365 pages, a page a day, I followed the daily office of the Episcopal order in order to get the text that I wanted to look at. And I'm sure that with that great variety and inventory of texts, I did operate with my usual interpretive assumptions, and that means, of course, that I had one eye out for abundance wherever it came up. And of course, if you just do a bunch of biblical texts, the idea of abundance does come up a great deal. So I'm pleased that I was able to get that book out. It proved to be more work than I had anticipated when I started. I should have known that with 365 days, but it kind of went on and on.
Well, now, I just want to make the point that this is not just for Episcopalians, that the Episcopalians use very similar or the same readings as most other mainline denominations.
That's right. And, of course, it's published by Westminster John Knox, which is a Presbyterian publisher, so I hope that it has a much broader appeal because it's not committed to any ecclesial or doctrinal narrowness, but it's just an attempt to read texts. And so I hope I will have a lot of people that engage in reading those texts along with me. Yes.
Indeed. Well, now, it's interesting to note for this year that Ash Wednesday, the first day of Lent, begins on February 14th, which just happens to be this year, St. Valentine's Day.
That's right. which puts a big choice in front of us, doesn't it? which one we should observe.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you have a collection of devotions for Lent, and it includes a biblical reading as well as a devotion and a closing prayer. And I assume that this collection would be good any year.
That's certainly my hope and my intent. That's also a collection of excerpts from my various writings, and I think it. I hope it'll have a good shelf life. It's not aimed particularly at this year, but the themes that we focus on in Lent are recurring. So,
Now, the subtitle is A Way Other Than Our Own. Where are you going with that?
Well, I understand Lent basically to mean to invite a focus on discipleship as a follower of Jesus. And it seems to me that Jesus' call to follow him, which he did with his initial disciples and continues to do, was a call away from our conventional way to his way, which is the way of sacrificial self-giving. And obviously, sacrificial self-giving tends not to be our ordinary, uncritical way. So a way other than our own is an invitation to order our daily life in a way that our culture would regard as risky and perhaps foolish. And I think that the 40 days of Lent are an opportunity not only to reflect on that. Reflection is very important, but more important than reflection is simply practice. So it invites us to think in a daily kind of a way about how do I organize my time, how do I organize my money, how do I organize my energy in a very different way because the way of Jesus is the way to well-being. That's kind of how I would factor that out.
You've been a supporter of voluntary simplicity for a long, long time, and it seems to me that this kind of discipline would lend itself toward the kind of Lenten discipline that you're talking about.
That's exactly right. I think that the specificity of a way other than our own way probably has particularly to do with consumerism and with the illusion that is very common among us that acquiring more stuff or more commodities or more goods will somehow make us happier. And it's perfectly clear in our society that that being sated with more consumer goods has not led to happiness or well-being or security. So I think the focus of your program of voluntary simplicity is exactly on target, and I'm sure that you intended not only for the Christmas season, but it really is a way of life. It is a way of life that's appropriate in every season of the year, and that, of course, is an accent that I intend to be making. So I do have the glad conviction that what you are up to and what I work at, we're very much on the same page about that. And I think that the happy awareness is that increasing numbers of people, particularly increasing numbers of young people, are coming to see that the way of consumer satiation really is a dead end that does not result in our well-being.
Thank you. Well, now let's move on to your most recent work, which is a work with your son, John, called Rebuilding the Foundations, Social Relationships in Ancient Scripture and Contemporary Culture. Now, right. The format of this book is really intriguing. It seems to be not a scholarly book and not a devotional book, but a dialogue. In fact, it's interesting that both of you answer a series of questions, and it's very clear who's talking because you put your initials at the beginning of each section.
Right. Yeah. Well, let me say first of all that you or anyone who has kids can imagine what a delight it was for me to get to publish that with my son John. He is a sociologist, and sociology is sort of my second discipline. So he and I have a great deal in common about that. And what we did to shape the book is that we agreed on six sort of general themes about social well-being, and then we each wrote our own essay on the theme independent of each other, and then we interacted with each other about his essays and my essays, and the process quite dialogical, I think that's right to say, and that's exactly what we intended.
Excellent. Well, it says that in this new book, you take a close look at our fractured American society and suggest ways for improvement. So why don't we take each one of those six themes, and you can give us maybe a thumbnail of what you had in mind. The first one is care.
Well, I think that has to do with neighborliness, and that we really do live by being in villages or in networks where people look after each other, and that it follows then that we have an obligation to be looking out for our neighbors in daily kinds of ways. And obviously that summons to to be caring and to be cared for is a contradiction of our widespread selfish individualism that does not look after anybody but oneself. And obviously that's very, very deeply rooted in the biblical tradition. But my son, as a sociologist, could also make the case, probably with reference to Durkheim, that society cannot function if there is not that kind of interactive care of neighbor to neighbor.
The second one is fairness.
Well, I think we both tried to write on fairness in the context of a society that is increasingly unfair as the gap between haves and have-nots becomes more and more exaggerated and more normalized. So the biblical tradition about equity and justice and righteousness for the neighbor means that you have to have procedures and regulations that will cause the strong and the weak to be able to live together. And obviously my son, as a sociologist, could see that the crisis of economic unfairness that is then propelled by political unfairness in terms of gerrymandering and voter repression and deregulation, those are all acts that are designed to make unfairness legitimate, and that obviously has to be resisted in every way that we can.
Indeed. Moving on then to the third, liberty.
Well, in the biblical tradition, I suppose that God's most recurring gospel word is, "Do not fear, for I am with you." And the epistle finally reaches the wonderful affirmation that perfect love casts out fear. So I think to be free of fear of loss of one's safety, loss of one's dignity, loss of one's wherewithal enables one then to be free for a different kind of life in the world in which we not only have a freedom to actualize our full selves, but in which we have freedom to give ourselves away for the sake of the neighbor. And obviously, the opposite of freedom, well, it can be coercion, but I think the real opposite of freedom is fear. When one lives a cautious or timid or retracted life that keeps us from facing our God-given potential. So I think the Reformed tradition in which I stand really believes that the gospel is essentially a gospel of freedom. But that liberty is not the liberty of private individualism. It is a liberty of shared humanity. And now, of course, we are also trying to think about the liberty of creation and non-human creatures who ought not to be under the gun of our endless exploitation and exhaustion. So freedom cuts across everything and contradicts the kinds of coercions that is too much present among us.
Indeed. Very inspiring. Thank you. Next is loyalty.
Well, the the Bible is committed to the proposition that we live by reliable interconnectedness, and the key Hebrew word for that in the Old Testament is chesed, which means steadfast, loyal love. And one recurring affirmation in the Bible is that God is a practitioner of steadfast, loyal love, and then we are summoned to practice that same kind of loyal love toward our neighbors. So the whole capacity to be reliable, to be trustworthy, to stand by our word, to honor our commitments, all of that in gospel parlance takes place in the midst of God's own fidelity. And that is counter to market ideology, which wants us to believe you don't owe anybody anything, and you ought to be self-made, and you ought to be self-sufficient, and you're not obligated to anybody. So I think there's no place at which the gospel clashes more with our dominant cultural values than around the question of loyalty and steadfast love.
We're speaking with Walter Brueggemann about his new book, co-authored with his son John Brueggemann, called Rebuilding the Foundations: Social Relationships in Ancient Scripture and Contemporary Culture. Of the six themes, the next one is authority.
Well, I think the most important matter is to distinguish between authority and authoritarianism. And we've much confused authority and authoritarianism. Authoritarianism, of course, is top-down coercion. But if you trace the word authority back to author, then the question of authority is who authors us? And the theological affirmation is that God is the author of our life, and therefore God is the authority to authorize us with freedom and responsibility. So we tend to bounce back and forth in our society between authoritarianism on the one hand and a kind of privatism that honors no authority and that ends up in nihilism. So we have a great deal of work to do in finding viable ways of responsibility and answerability that do not fall off either into unmitigated autonomy on the one hand or to coercive authoritarianism on the other hand. And I think that's an endless task that we have to work at.
Indeed, an important distinction. And finally, sanctity.
Well, sanctity is a big word for what the Bible calls holy, I guess. If you work in the Old Testament, the opposite of holy is profane, or profanity, or pornography. I think that we live in an increasingly profane society in which everything is emptied of awe and reverence and humility. And so one can begin with the biblical affirmation that none is holy but God. So God is an agent who invites awe and reverence and humility. But then God is always at work in forming a holy people, so you shall become holy as God is holy. And that means to preserve at the center of our common life a kind of an awe and reverence and honor that refuses to be cheapened or trivialized or commoditized. And it is very difficult in a market ideology to maintain any sense of holiness that backs off in awe about the mystery of life. So I think there is, with the accent on the recent book that says what we need is a new Benedict, meaning the great monk who founded the Benedictine order, is a recognition that our life has become so cheap and so thin and so trivial that we really have to be in a mode of recovery about the mystery that is at the center of our common life. Well, Jerry almost made it unnecessary to buy the book because I've given such a good review, but I hope people will want to look to see how we have lined it out in dialogic form.
Indeed. It's so good to catch up with you on your latest works, but I can't imagine Walter Brueggemann not having another project on the fire. What's coming up in the future?
Well, I have a couple of little books at the publisher. One is on coercive silence in the Bible, and one is on why we sing. It's an attempt to move from the Book of Psalms to hymn singing in the church to try to show why it is such an elemental requirement among us. And then I have a collection of essays that is my most recent work that is also at the publisher. And I think when I get those three manuscripts done, I will probably be finished. I don't think I'm going to do more work, but those will be forthcoming in the next 2 years, I would guess. Yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to those indeed. You've been listening to my conversation with theologian Walter Brueggemann. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com, on our Simple Living Works Facebook page, or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org, click window number 3. Also, it really helps our visibility when you give Simple Living Works a 5-star review on iTunes. I urge you to subscribe to one of Simple Living Works' free publications. Our blog is called Simpler Living Weekly Nudge. Just send the word blog to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. Need a nudge? I've been producing today's Simpler Living Nudge for over a year and a half and welcome you to subscribe for free. Receive a short, thought-provoking item every day by email or Twitter. Just send me an email with the subject nudge at simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. In 2018, Simple Living Works Weekly Digest has been discontinued, and the Simple Living Works podcast reduced to 1 episode per month, issued on the 15th. The complete Simple Living Works Monthly Digest on the Simple Living Works site will continue to feature the latest posts from colleague organizations and will be updated weekly. Simple Living Works Weekly Nudge will feature offerings from Simple Living Works. It comes as your free subscription to our blog. Choose the options that work for you. Subscribers to Simple Living Works podcast will receive the Common Good podcast, which I produce and co-host, on the first of the month. Likewise, subscribers to the Common Good podcast will receive Simple Living Works podcast on the 15th as a bonus. So, Simple Living Works podcast subscribers will continue to receive 2 episodes per month. This makes good sense, since the missions of both Simple Living Works and Jubilee One Earth Economics are so complementary, and the two work together closely. For example, I blog on the Jubilee site at casajubileo.org occasionally. Your comments on these changes are welcome. I'm lining up inspiring thinkers and activists for the year. Richard Heinberg of the Post-Carbon Institute. Educator and author Mark Birch. Author and green financial advisor Susan Taylor. And Don Hall of Transitions USA. Since I converse with many writers, you may want to read some of their books. I have strong opinions and hopefully helpful suggestions about where to get books. I hope you'll read my short article. The link is in the show notes. Time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will now through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simpleLivingWorks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast, our weekly blog, and Daily Nudge are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news rather than the weekly blog. The e-news is now the mid-month edition of the blog. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on the show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All of our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity. Choosing to live simpler lives is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everyone's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, "Live simply that others may simply live," as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. As you may sense, we put a strong emphasis on social justice. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The 3 parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast each month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.